You're listening to Art International Radio, www.artonair.org. My name is Zephyr Thrall. The show is called Frank Prattle. You might also be listening at www.frankprattle.com. Today, my very special guest, Cecily Brown. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. For those of you who don't know, Cecily is a painter. An oil painter tends to be, although you do some watercolors and
some
pen and ink as
gouache
well.
Gouache and ink and so on. Not really watercolor so much. It's much too difficult.
All right, fair enough. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do in your own words.
Let's see. Well, I've lived in New York for 15 years now, but I'm originally from London, or at least born in London. Grew up in the suburbs or the country. But came to New York in 92 and decided that this was the best place I'd ever been and that I had to come and live here.
What caught you at first? Do you remember like a something?
The funny thing is, it's things that people don't often mention all that much. It's things like the light. I was very seduced by the light here and the look of the place. I think coming from somewhere that's so gloomy, I came in the winter, and that even on the most freezing, brutal days, you'd have this extraordinary bright blue, crisp clearness.
Yeah.
I don't know. I walked around on cloud nine for 6 months. I just loved it so much. I was supposed to be in school here. I didn't like the school that they'd put me on exchange.
What school?
At. It was actually the studio school. Because, you know, I was at the Slade School in London.
Right.
And we could do an exchange. So I'd said, well, I fancy New York. And they go ahead and plan where you're going to go. I mean, it's not that I have anything against the studio school per se, but it was not right for me at all.
Right, right.
I mean, I'd done lots of life drawing in the past, but I wasn't interested in it very much at that moment. So, I more or less spent the 6 months just wandering the city, and I love walking, and I just walk, you know, back and forth and up and down, and still had to go back to London to finish doing my degree. It was just a fine arts degree, undergrad, but knew that as soon as I could figure out how to get here, this was where I wanted to be. It was the light, the architecture, the one big part of it was. It felt very, very open in terms of what the kind of work I was seeing in the galleries.
Right.
The art world felt a lot more all-encompassing than the London art world at that time.
Do you think it's flip-flop now?
I feel like the art worlds everywhere have just become a bit more like each other, just in that there's been such a boom since then that, you know, I mean, London has something like 300 galleries in the East End now, apparently. I just read. I mean, that's just such a surprise to me.
Yeah.
I mean, of course it's changed drastically since I left, but excuse me, to hear that it's really on that scale at this point. You know, when I was there were, you know, perhaps a dozen. I mean, obviously there were more smaller things, but
right.
There were very few that one would actually want to have anything to do with. I kind of feel like the art world's more generic now. I mean, less, that each place is more like each other place.
More like that partly glowing box of the computer over there, kind of.
Partly because of art fairs, you know, they've become so huge. I mean, who knows now what's going to happen? I mean, I feel like we're talking about this is all in the past now.
Could be. Although I was talking to a friend this morning about Dubai and flying into Dubai and like that odd spectacle of like a weird green oasis in the middle of just flat white sand, right?
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly Dubai is growing still. Even though the economic downturn.
So. Right.
Maybe we'll just all move there.
Well, you never know. It sounds kind of scary. Conjures up sort of gated communities. And
Michael Jackson.
I guess the weather's nice.
I guess so.
Well, even the weather's getting more like everywhere else all the time. I mean, in England now, you get summer, you know, sometimes.
Madness.
Yes.
So you moved to New York.
I moved here.
You were piss broke.
Yep. Lived, you know, I was, another thing I loved was that it was very easy to live on nothing here. I found a cheap place to live, which was, now obviously you can't, but with a little tiny studio and...
Whereabouts?
White Street. $500 for a studio on White Street and and worked as a waitress. And, you know, lived on pizza and bagels and got really fat and drank for free and sort of just met people. The people I first knew here were people who drank in the bar where I worked and later the restaurant. And, you know, was painting from straight away. Actually, that's a total lie. I just realised, I just jumped, because when I very first got here, I actually worked doing animation.
Okay.
And I made a film in 95, which some people have seen.
What's it called?
It's called Four Letter Heaven.
I haven't seen it.
It's a 2.5 minute animated film. And actually, no, sorry, I just jumped, because I was actually, I was very suspicious of painting for a little while and was trying to actually work in other mediums. After I'd left art school, but it was actually doing this animation that really got me back into colour and painting. I got a job doing animation. That was how I first survived here. And in my free time, my boss let me use the equipment, and I made this little film of my own.
Nice.
The method he'd taught me. And
now, animation is one of the most labor-intensive loves I've ever seen, man.
Yeah.
Like, you talk about, like, one oil painting or a series, like, you know, a big series, let's say 50 or something like that. But, you know, you're making an animation that's, like, hundreds of, like, the same sketch.
No, it's 24 drawings a second, so that's a real lot. And I loved the method that my boss taught me. His name's Jeff Shear. He's still making films. Is you know, the frame by frame, you could change things quite a lot.
Right.
So it wasn't, you weren't sort of tied down to this very, it wasn't nearly as precise.
Right.
The commercials we worked on had to be very precise, and that I was terrible at. But when you could, you know, be much freer, I really enjoyed it. And so at my little White Street studio, I started painting again after, you know, I'd just been trying to do sort of cooler art for a while, because I was embarrassed about being a painter.
Yes, because there was the plague of painting.
Yeah. And in London, it was really, you know, you just felt like such a leper being a painter.
Yeah.
And it just eventually got under your skin. So much as I still loved looking at paintings, it was kind of hard to justify why it was okay to paint. And but I've always, I like the fact that the film was what led me back into it. Because I'd slowly allowed myself to paint again, but there were all sorts of rules, and one rule was no colour. So it was like, as long as it was austere, if it was in black and white, there was somehow less, you know, it was less guilt-making. But the film was very colourful. And I actually still think to this day that the film informed the way I work, because as you'll see in the studio, there are, you know, 15 things of the same size going on at the same time. And I work, I don't even think of them as series, but I love the idea of going from one to the next almost frame by frame.
Right.
I mean, it's a little pretentious to equate it with film. I think people do that much too often.
Go ahead now, go ahead.
It's like another excuse. It's like, no, it's a painting. You know, just deal. It is a, but I've always loved that. I really like looking from one painting to another, and that relationship and sort of what happens, you know, in your head between them and to your eye and to the paintings. So to have two very similar paintings side by side, where it almost could be like, you know, a film.
Right.
A two-frame film.
Right, where there's the
just with the shift.
Motion. Yeah, just slight
shift. I mean,
shift.
I would say a sort of shifting is one of the things I'm most concerned with.
All right. So for the listening audience, we're sitting right now in your studio and in Manhattan, and there is, I don't know how many up right now, maybe 50 paintings, maybe 40?
Steady on. I don't know if they're quite that many.
Up on the walls right now, so the place is literally awash in color, and it looks absolutely gorgeous. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. And one of the things that we were talking about earlier is that you have been switching up your painting practice due to a newcomer.
Yeah. Well, I'm 6 months pregnant. So, well, the bad news was I was told at first, don't paint at all.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if I ever get time, I might write the book on how you can paint while you're pregnant. Because I just got so terrified that this was it. And I only know, I have one friend, Jacqueline Humphreys, and she's the only painter mom I know.
Oh.
I mean, I know, of course, there are others older, but she's the only one in my a friend. And she said, no, don't worry, I painted through the whole thing. But, and then the huge but is that suddenly it's all about masks and gloves and,
right,
you know, dodgy materials and things that one's used for years that are poisonous. I mean, I've always used things that I knew were bad for me, but the minute it's bad for someone
else,
it slightly changes things.
But you're lucky, though, it's painting, though. You're not doing some crazy, like, alabaster dust sculpture thing, you know.
No, and in fact, the adjustments that I've made, I've really, you know, I think it's been quite good for me. I've been using different mediums, and one of the most interesting things that's happened, which I think I'll carry on doing long after the baby is born, is, that the painting stays wet for longer.
Yeah.
So whereas in the past, if I painted one day, by the time I came back in the next day, the thing was too dry to change, too wet to work on,
right,
but too tacky that you couldn't really get back into it the next day. Well, now I'm using all these different, I'm using more oil, safflower oil, walnut oil.
Goop.
Goop, yep. And other mediums made by somebody I just recently found, a person called Doak in Brooklyn, who makes all his own mediums. And this, the thing of them staying wet longer is actually working really well for me. You don't have to be in quite such a panic every night when you finish painting.
Because,
I mean, without losing the sense of urgency, which I've always quite liked, ever since I was a sort of very young painter and sort of very romantic, have this thing of like, however you leave it, you know, that could be it. You know,
right,
to sort
right.
of leave the studio at night as if you
if
might
I were
never,
to die on the train home.
Like, is this okay? So, which I think is quite a nice, healthy attitude because it makes you very tough on yourself, and that even if you painted for 6 or 8 hours, if it doesn't, you know, you're more likely to scrape it off or wipe it off at the end
right.
of the day or make some take some big risk at the end of the day. I've always had this thing where the last hour or half hour of the day is by far the most productive.
Definitely.
I mean,
definitely.
You know, if I have to be somewhere at 6, you could, you know, at 5, that's when it all happens. Or, but, so I'm trying to keep that urgency, but in a way it's, I'm really liking being able to leave something and still try and keep that thing of if I die tonight.
Right. Right.
But then come back in and actually I can still shift things around
right.
The next day. That was a rather long-winded explanation. So.
No, you did well. Don't worry. Yeah. Tally-ho. So you know, I think that this isn't going to come as a shock or any surprise. Your painting has definitely changed over the last, you know, 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
Like it has changed, you know, a considerable amount.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I would say, in the last, you know, maybe 5 to 8 years around
right.
there. That you've gone in a new direction, and you, you know, for those listening, this is a product plug, all right? She has a new book out. What is it, self-titled, no?
Yes, it's just my name.
Just tell us a little bit about this new book, because it's kick-ass. It's peach, I would say.
Coral, I think.
Coral, tangerine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the cover is the color, which is the sort of color that I spend most of my life using, I could say overusing. And then trying to escape from, and then embracing, and then thinking, whoa, it's that bloody pinky orange again. But I sort of, the cover is pinkish orange. It's my, it's 10 years of work, more or less. And, well, it's selected, obviously. There's an essay by Dori Ashton.
Good one.
Yeah, we decided, you know, I thought it would be really great to get somebody from, you know, an older person to write something. I figured there are hopefully many years to come where I can get the new person
right.
to see what their point of view is. And, you know, I've had a few catalogues because, lucky for me, Gagosian tends to make catalogues.
Right.
So I've had the opportunity to have a few essays and choose a writer. And it just seemed different and fresh, actually, to have someone like Dori, whose writing I admired and who I figured really knows painting and, you know, obviously is mostly associated with the New York School and Guston. I would say she's most famous for,
yeah.
or at least she was to me. And, you know, being a huge Guston admirer,
right.
like most painters, Just thought Dory seemed like a really interesting choice.
Pink goop.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there's an interview with
Larry Pittman and I did an interview.
Which is a good one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, his questions were quite tough, I must say.
He had some zingers in there, didn't he?
Yeah,
I was like, that's a $10 question.
Yeah. So again, we thought it'd be really interesting to do a painting, an interview with an artist. And I'm a great admirer of his work. And he seemed, you know, it seemed like someone out of left field. Not the most obvious choice.
Right.
I mean, I don't know who would have been.
Are you guys friends, or was that?
Well, we've become friendly through this.
Oh, okay.
We weren't. I've always really liked his work, and I thought he was an interesting choice because, you know, the work is so different from mine, but at the same time, like in the application and the process, and for those who don't know my work, it's rather, you know, I work pretty much organically. I mean, it's quite. I tend to pile it on and take it off, and it's not that planned at all. Whereas Pittman's work, I don't have a clear image of how the end thing will look.
Right, right.
That's kind of the fun for me.
Right,
is to the surprise and to keep going until I know it's right. But
right.
Basically, the process is knowing it's wrong, and then finally. It gets close to, you know, I feel perhaps there's an unconscious image of what I want it to be, but it's not even, you know, I discover it as I go along.
Right.
Now, I'm sure someone like Larry Pittman, you couldn't work like that. You have to have a much more precise way of, you know, where something's going to go. Now, I'm sure still surprises take place.
I should hope so.
But,
you know, otherwise, it'd get hell boring.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? But I just figured, because we're both quite all over, we both have quite a lot of emotive and erotic content. So it was kind of an amusing choice.
Yeah. Speaking of erotic content, let's tackle that beast, shall we?
Yeah, okay.
Your work has been described in I would say probably the most vastly different ways, you know, on both ends of the spectrum that I've ever heard. You know, from, what is it, Schwendener, however you say her name, from your last show, her review in the Times of your show, Gagosian, it was a pornographic spectacle, I believe she called it. And then I've heard, you know, other people, a dear friend of mine who describes your work as the closest that she's ever seen to somebody visually representing an orgasm.
Oh.
You know what I mean? And she means that in the best possible way, you know what I mean? Not the prude way.
Right.
And so people seem fairly divided about your work, and
yeah.
a lot of times that comes with kind of erotic territory, I would say. What are your feelings on that? It's a tough one, I know.
Yeah,
take your
yeah.
time, don't worry.
No, I think it is a tough one to talk about because, first of all, I mean, I think my attitude has changed and the work has changed and things that I might have, you know, things that I've showed 10 years ago were much more in-your-face, erotic, verging on pornographic. You know, at one time I was very interested in seeing how far I could push erotica and still so that it didn't actually end up pornographic,
right.
but how to use pretty incendiary material,
right.
but still keep it not fine art, but how do you have what might be very titillating material, but that it leads one to actually contemplation of the painting, and that how possible was it to get beyond the imagery?
Right.
Like to use, I definitely think I used the, of course I've thought about this a lot and
right.
sort of thought, what did I think at the time and what, in retrospect, and I think I might have said this in that interview actually.
You did, I think.
Yeah. Just that now when I look back, I think I rather used certain erotic imagery to get attention, for the painting, to make people stop in their tracks. Because I think especially with all my guilt about painting and how unpopular painting was, in the early 90s, I think I really felt like if you're going to be a painter, you've really got to have something coming from left field, something unexpected and something right. not shocking. Well, yeah, I guess maybe with an element of shock. Something that's really going to make people stop in their tracks.
Which I think you did. I mean, the first time that I had ever heard of you was, I'd heard from friends before, but I'd never seen anything of yours, but it was a Flash Art article, like maybe 10 years ago, and I was living in this warehouse in Portland, and somebody added, like, it was, like, propped up to hold the tank up. It was like a Flash Art magazine. So I like grabbed it and was reading it.
Right.
And you know, just flipping through, and it's horrible crap. And then I saw one of your paintings, and it definitely made an impression. Like right. a seizing impression.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I first started.
Well, I think it slightly backfired, because when I say I wanted attention, that of course sounds like I wanted attention for myself and to get, you know, I mean, I wanted, how does the painting stop people and get their attention
exactly.
in a world where, you know, the classic cliche of, you know, you're vying with a billion images a day.
Right.
The more popular thing at the time was video and photography. So I felt that I'd walk through galleries with people and there was a sort of attitude of like, oh, painting, and that people felt they got it before they even looked at it. I felt nobody ever gave painting a minute, and that... I wanted it to be like, no, you've got to look at me, you know, and be arresting. Now, but I'd also been used erotic imagery since I very first started painting. And I think that was down to the art that interested me, the art that I responded to of other people, whether it was Picasso or Bonnar or Bacon, anyone from the very beginning of the first artist you see, Egon Schiele. I mean, was one of the first person I liked when
high
I was
school crush
16.
Of mine. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You see that and you're like, oh my God, art can be rude
yeah.
and art can be outrageous and sexy and, you know, nasty. Yeah.
Did you go through a Klimt phase afterwards or no?
I never really did the Klimt thing as much.
Well, look
I think
at
maybe
you.
Being,
highbrow, good job.
Yeah. Well, I think partly being female, that Klimt maybe seemed the more obvious classic feminine choice.
Right.
So I rejected that.
I just like the gold. Like it looked like a painting made of like gold money.
Right,
you know what I
yeah.
mean? Anyway.
I loved Klimt drawings. I never really got into the paintings as much. Because I think I was as interested in subject. You know, like I remember some amazing lesbian drawings by Klimt. I was always, maybe then more than even now, that when I was first interested in art, the subject was... really what hooked me in. And that's probably then makes sense that when I started painting, I wanted there to be a meaty subject,
right,
both
right.
literally and metaphorically. Something I also thought, you know, I mean, I've kind of... This all seems terribly cliché to even say. I think, but I'm just thinking about when I was young and what my thoughts were about this kind of subject matter, something that's universal...
Right.
Something that doesn't really need explaining.
Right.
I wanted something very direct. One of the main things was I wanted to use the body. I wanted to use skin, flesh, and movement. But I didn't want to just paint a nude. I wanted there to be action. I was very always loved movement in paintings. So it's kind of a combination of the formal, as in, like, I love Rubens, and I always loved the buoyancy of people like Titian.
Yeah.
So how do you... But I was like, I'm not going to be painting in... Bacchus floating, you know, or an angel. So how do you have buoyancy and levity in a painting?
Right.
And so all these things, again and again, I just found that erotic subject matter served my purpose.
Right.
You could have emotion, you know, it was emotional, it was action, it was, you know, just, it was a great vehicle in a way to carry all this other stuff.
One of the quotes that I think from your new book that really struck me was that you said you wanted painting to be able to convey the figurative imagery in a kind of shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that, you know, fascinates me, is the idea of, you know, my mother worked as as an office worker for years.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And she could type about 70 words a minute. You know what I mean?
Right.
But people who write shorthand, much faster than that. You know, like they can type as fast as anyone can ever talk.
Uh-huh.
But that idea of shorthand is so rarely, I think, carried over into artistic means. You know
right.
what I mean? Like there's the idea of suggestion and things like that. But it seems that you're trying more for an actual language
yes.
of conveyance in that sense. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, that's a good next question because, you know, that's sort of gradually what has happened, I think, and that what you say is the drastic change of the last years. In a way, it's just sort of naturally become... I mean, I think the more I've painted, the more I've kind of developed a shorthand. And in the last couple of years, in the thing works that people tend to describe as more abstract, even though I don't really use that word very often.
Tell me why. What's wrong with abstract in abstraction?
This was nearly the thing I said when you said, was there something I wanted to talk about? And then I realized...
I just love... Are those abstract? Those are great.
Well, I think the reason it bothers me... It doesn't bother me if you'd say Rothko's abstract. It just bothers me if you say that I am. Just because... And I'm trying to let go of minding so much.
It's okay.
I think it's because during the making, I never feel it's fully abstract. I don't feel there's a difference in attitude when I whether I'm painting a clear figure or, you know, a field of blue. I feel like there's the same impulse, the same... I don't make the distinction myself, but when I'm... I think the paintings are only successful when, in mentally, I'm grasped onto something very particular. So there's always... It's about sort of particularity and specificity and trying to pin something down. And more, that thing isn't necessarily apparent to the viewer as I meant it. And that's, I think, what I'm... The reason they look more abstract or less obviously representational is that I've kind of let go of the need for the viewer to see it as I meant it.
Right.
If that makes sense.
It does.
So that I'm much more open to an ambiguous reading.
Right.
I feel like that. I know the forms are ambiguous. I don't understand. I'd have a fantasy that there's a scholar out there who knows that every time I make a certain mark, that yes, it is shorthand for this very particular gesture, and that they might realize that this set of lines means a fist.
Are you training somebody in Vienna right now? the brownies?
It's something I really go back and forth on because... You know, sometimes I'll be in front of a painting and I could go through it and say, well, that's obvious, you know, and actually explain away each thing. Well, not explain away, but give an explanation. But I think I actually am also becoming more reluctant to do that and understand that when the paintings work, that some of their power is the not knowing, the undecided, the sort of up in the airness. And I think more and more it's become about, you know, opening up, hopefully, the imagination of the viewer in a way that mine is open as I'm painting, that there are possible, different possible readings, that it isn't, that it is in a state of flux.
Now, this is a question that dovetails into that. What is the ideal viewing distance from your painting? What do you want people to see your painting at? Because I think that often dictates what image people bring.
Absolutely. Away. I think... Well, if you saw my last show, I think the way we installed it was I was trying to say I want people to look at it from every distance. And one of the reasons that I hung very small paintings in this with big ones was to try and get that across, that I want them to work from a vast distance.
Right.
And I want someone to go as close in as possible.
Right.
I mean, you're a painter too. You know that when you're painting... You go in very close, and you go middle distance, and you go far.
Right.
And my ideal viewing distance would be someone to keep moving and see it from a side, you know, look askew at a thing, stand and look at one, and then turn their head slightly and look at another. You know, look at one, go across the room and look at it, you know, see it with three others in your peripheral vision.
Right.
And I think that show, I was in a way happier with the installation than with any individual works because... I felt that it was sort of quite eloquent about how I want to see the work as a whole and what I want each work to encapsulate in that it does have this constant motion and this thing of just not really giving an answer. And that the process of looking becomes very like the process of working. And that, you know, if there was any kind of message, And that might have started with the sex paintings of like, look at me. But it's not, you know, it's like, look at me and then look again and come, you know, that eventually it kind of opens up a sort of daydream space for the viewer.
Okay.
But a profound space, not as your sort of wilpy daytime TV daydream. But,
although, you know, there's nothing wrong with that novella watchers.
No, that's... You know, I like there to be many levels. I want paintings to be funny.
Right.
I want them to be sad.
Have you ever seen someone in a gallery looking at your paintings laughing?
I have, actually.
Yeah?
Oh, it made me so happy.
Did it really?
Yeah, because they are meant to be funny. There is humor in them.
Yeah.
I'll laugh sometimes when I make them because, you know, especially I think with these smaller ones, because I would get so involved with these little worlds and get so sort of sucked in. I find them humorous. I never asked what they were laughing at. I might not have been so pleased if I had found out.
Yeah, like they're having a good time. That's good enough.
Yeah. No, you know, I think often there's... I want them to run the whole gamut of emotions. I have pretty grand ambitions for my paintings. I'd like people to... You know, but my ideal really is when somebody says, oh, I stood there for half an hour.
Ah.
Or someone who owns a painting might tell me, well, I keep, you know, oh, I love the way it keeps changing. You know, that you can never quite get a final grip on it.
Now, I had a question for you.
Yeah.
As far as influence, mm-hmm. all right? You, looking over at your bookshelf, you know, for the listener, there's a bookshelf to the ceiling, what, 12 feet high, 10 feet? And it is probably one of the most impressive bookshelves I've ever seen because it goes three deep in places. There's a row of books, another row of books, and then behind it yet another row of books. And mostly it appears to be art books.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah. So one could say that you definitely are influenced by quite a bit. I assume they're your books, no?
Yeah, they're mostly mine. There are a few architecture books that belong to my husband.
Okay.
Mostly they're mine.
And so looking at that, what are some of the things that you're taking away today? I mean, because have you ever heard that it might be true, might be not. But David Byrne said about Prince that he heard that Prince only listens to his own music.
Oh, no.
That he sits in his studio and will listen to, you know, his new album, mm. then an old album, and
really?
Then he'll go, like, make a song
huh.
only based off his own, you know, style
well,
and his own inbred circular, you know, kind of system like that.
Right.
And you definitely seem to be somebody who's looking for resources.
I look outside a lot, but I can see why that can be useful. I mean... When we were putting this book together, we'd have the dummies, you know, and they immediately became source material in the studio because it was like this fantastic resource to have one's own work nicely reproduced.
Right.
Loose. So you've got this loose-leafed version so you can quickly refer to stuff. But in a way, I like having some of my own stuff around to make sure I don't repeat myself too much because that's the other useful thing about book and stuff is that you just realize that this is very like something I've done. I do actually have some of my own stuff kicking around and I always have it mixed up with other things. Yeah, I have, I more or less have the same sort of hardcore of painters that I've looked at for, you know, since I started painting.
Let's take a walk over to the bookshelf, shall we?
Okay.
All right, you're coming. The listener is coming with us right now.
Okay. There's one book you'll see here. It's called Horrors. This was actually on the bookshelf when I was a child. And it's called A Chamber of Horrors. Horrors. And this was one of my favorite books as a kid. And now I love the fact that, you know, these were the first paintings I really loved.
There's it's Bosch.
Bosch. There's Munch. They're basically... It's an anthology of the macabre in words and pictures. So there are stories by Edgar Allan Poe. And then, you know, this is some of the first art I ever saw.
Wow.
And they're pretty terrifying things for a child
to
look at.
Yeah.
Tibetan Brontes, there's Goya.
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's an anthology. I would say the main... Wait. This is, at random, these are the kind of shelves. These are the most accessible shelves. So,
right.
I mean,
you've got books on Chinese eroticism next to Beardsley, next to, you know, Augustine, who we were talking about earlier, next to Greco. One of my old favorites, Soutine.
Yeah.
You know, what have you been looking at recently though? What's
I've been looking at tons of Breugel and Bosch.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm completely Breugel. Bosch, I've sort of always looked at a bit, but he's become my main man.
Your squeeze
for a while, yeah. And then Breugel. Now there are three Breugels, so I should be more specific. I always forget who's who, even while I'm in love with him. It's Pieter the Younger that I'm really looking at a lot.
And you've got a Manet book kicking here?
Yeah. I just picked these up because they're this new or newish series.
Yeah, because it's cheap and it's small and I love it.
And you don't mind if you get, it's kind of, it's a great studio book. They open, they stay open.
Right.
They're these new little Taschen paperbacks. Reproductions aren't too bad.
My grandmother, she was a painter. She painted a reproduction of that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's horrible. But I got it when she died. I was like, ah!
Right.
That and a nude bust somebody painted of her. Like, it was pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah?
Steamy.
Oh,
yes.
God.
Anyway.
Right.
One of the things that people, I don't think, often talk about when they talk about your work and really shows up in the book is your drawing,
mm-hmm.
and your ink work as
right.
well, which, you know, if you were to just go to your shows, you would
yeah,
never
I've never
see.
Shown any of them.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about that.
I'm going to sit back down.
Sure.
I am thinking of showing some at some point. Drawing's been something that I always did a lot of. As a kid, and I drew long before I painted, but I almost always drew in sketchbooks, and I've always been really shy about showing drawings, and once I started exhibiting, I guess there's some things that about paintings that so much more obviously they're meant to be in the world, and I think.
Forgive me if I'm mistaken, but I think they are the most archival thing that we've come up with so far.
Oil paintings.
Yeah, because there's like Giotto paintings that are, mm-hmm. hundreds and hundreds
right.
of years old, things like that.
Yeah, you can hang them in the light. Yeah. No, they're really tough.
Yeah.
I love that about them. I mean, the way I treat my paintings in here is, they're really tough. They just get kicked around and everything. I don't know. I get very shy and self-conscious about drawings, and it's something. And in fact, in the last 5 years or so, I've done a bit less of it until quite recently. And I got, actually, when I first got pregnant, I started drawing a lot in ink again, which I love ink. And I'd completely left it, I'd forgotten about it almost. I think as I got bigger and bigger with the paintings, I kind of let drawing fall by the wayside a bit. And
right.
the paintings became much more, because I never drew as studies for paintings. So it wasn't as if I feel I've neglected it a bit because I don't sort of need drawing in order to start a painting.
Right. So one of the things that I see in your ink work, in your drawing, is somewhat a similarity between you and Kara Walker's work. I think
mm-hmm.
that you have similar line weight, both
right,
of you
yeah.
guys. What do you think about her work?
Oh, yeah, I think she's a terrific artist. When I first saw her drawings, I was very jealous and just thought, oh! And I thought not just the line, but something of the sensibility, and obviously her work is so focused on particular content, but some of the things she was looking at, some of her obvious source materials were things that there's something about that line that I think I was often drawn to the same things.
Right.
A certain Victorian line,
right.
The
right.
ruffles, the bonnets and the ribbons
right.
and there's something
mixed with the darker underbelly of something behind the curtain.
Well, I think the something behind the curtain somehow in art of that, I guess like late 19th century, often a lot of prints and popular, graphic work of that period. It's hard to describe exactly what I mean, but it's almost as if the dark underbelly is enclosed in those forms that somehow.
Right.
It's kind of like the negative space in some of these drawings seems very animated and very almost there's an innocence in what's depicted, but there's an aggression in what's not, but that almost if he were to take... I mean, I think the same is true in Degas and Goya and people as well. Well, not and people, they're nothing like each other, but there's something about... there can be this suggestiveness in the space around things that really is where all the horror is, and or the erotica, or the... So even if it's a relatively simple picture of a woman at her toilet, if you look sort of... A way I look at work a lot, actually, I just realized I did it, half close your eyes,
yes,
like to sort of squint at things, and you see what the picture's really about.
That's excellent advice.
And that's how I paint, and that's how I look at art a lot, is... I think Degas is almost the master of it, that if you suddenly see that there are kind of monstrous forms lurking...
Secret images,
under the
yes.
bed, the bedstead, the shadow of the mirror, the reflections... And there, actually, you know, it's not the nude at all. It's everything
right.
around her is electrified, you know, is that's where all the energy is, and that's where, like, the... what gives it such a sort of presence.
Yes. It was maybe 12 years ago or something, 10 years ago. I was in Seattle, and a friend dragged me to a Chuck Close exhibit
mm-hmm.
at the Seattle Art Museum, and I was not interested. I was like, I'll go because you're going, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, like... big portraits, you know, great. But there was a long hallway, and I took my glasses off to clean them. And all of a sudden, like, all the paintings got, like, awesome. Because it was all blurry
right.
all of a sudden. Like,
mm-hmm.
and just kind of the shifting shapes underneath.
Right.
So now...
Well, yeah, because often I think the wrong part of your brain gets involved too early, as it
right,
were.
Right, right.
And that's also... Yeah, one sees the subject and stops, or one sees what the sort of picture's ostensibly of... And any painter, like I think, you know, Manet or someone as well, you know, yes, there's what it's of.
Right.
That's usually, you know, less than a third of the painting.
Right.
And if the rest isn't on fire, the whole thing's going to collapse.
How much, like some artists, though, they try to go, you know, and circumvent that by, you know, the title. The title will
yeah.
give, like, kind of the inside shot, you
mm-hmm.
know, to what it's really about, or kind of more of a suggestion of which direction to go, you know what
yeah.
I mean? How important are your titles?
I mean, I think, like a lot of people, I'd rather that, you know, they can be a real pain. It's hard. It's hard to keep thinking of new titles all the time that give the right amount of information without being misleading, you know, that's partly why years ago I used to use ready-made titles all the time. I always used either songs or movies. But,
old films.
Old films, often musicals. And I thought that gave a sort of lightness and wit to what otherwise... That's when the paintings, people seemed to think they were very abex, and I didn't ever think they were. But because, you know, abex is so famously macho and,
right.
you know, takes itself so seriously... Those at that time, I think the titles were very useful to kind of, they did state more where I was coming from, that I wanted them to have a humour and a levity, as well as, yes, I wanted them to have this meatiness, but I've always wanted there to be, you know, a dichotomy within each painting and with works in relation to one another that... you know, that it can be very heavy and very light at the same time. So I think in those days the titles were really useful. I kind of ran out of suitable movies because what I never wanted to do was, you know, if you started, they were nearly always older films, because if you used a recent film, well, then people would start to read it in a narrative way or a
yeah.
descriptive way.
Right.
So, I mean, some of my titles I love. I've usually had, the ones I'm really fond of, I've had help with. I have a couple of friends who have a brilliant writer friend who has helped with some of my favorite titles. He's just got a knack for it.
Yeah,
I've gone through phases of just having descriptive things, red painting.
Right.
But that gets you into trouble. I mean, I called these things black paintings, and everyone assumed that was after Goya.
Right.
And it was a bloody stupid title to give it, because they were, you know, the black paintings were... You know, there was a woman on a bed. It looked like she was having a sort of nightmare. So, of course, it conjured up Goya's The Sleep of Reason.
Right, right.
Which, of course, I was thinking of, among other things. But I was so embarrassed about those afterwards because it seemed like I'm equating myself with Goya or saying, and now here are my black paintings.
Right, right.
Which I didn't really mean. I should have really thought that one out better. The funny thing is they came right after red paintings. So I was like, okay, red painting, black painting.
Right. How important, or rather, you know, you talked about some of the things that you regret. What would you say your largest regret in painting has been, in art, what have you?
Personal regret?
Biggest fuck up.
I mean, there are some paintings from the very early years which I wish I hadn't let out. Obviously, I'm not going to name them. I think I got, luckily, I got pretty strict pretty early. As I said, that thing about leaving the studio as if it might be your last day. I think it's extremely hard to be a good judge of your own work. Sometimes I wish I'd edited more. There are only a couple that really make me cringe.
Yeah?
Yeah, but, there's obviously nothing you can do.
You could go buy them.
I can't afford them.
You're like, could I just please have it back?
Yeah, no. I mean, they're probably, I've said this, it's so funny, when we're choosing things for the book, you know, and people I work with at the gallery whose eye I totally trust, you know, and they'd be like, are you crazy? That's a good one. And they don't, you know, someone right. I was working with who doesn't say that about everything. Right. But she was surprised at how many I was like, oh, no, you know. Yeah. But I sort of go waver because I know I'm extremely self-critical. But I think that's very important. The gallery is usually shocked at how, you know, I'll say a painting's horrible that they think is a decent painting. And
do you think that your gallery and that you've surrounded yourself with people who are, you know, I would say a good judge, that you haven't surrounded yourselves, some would say, you know, such as our dear president right now, with yes men, you know what I mean?
I think one of the advantages of having such a big gallery is that there's a really wide range of people who work there. So, you know, I appreciate the question because I could certainly, if I wanted to just hear nice things, I'd know who to go to.
Right.
You know, there are certain people who are never critical, really.
Right.
But I also, I'm not going to do a show and not ask. You know, there are two or three people who I know would say not this one. And, I mean, it's obviously much more challenging and interesting working with someone who's going to say this one sucks and why. And Larry himself, who I, you know, work fairly closely with, is an extremely tough critic. And, I think contrary to what people might expect, he's not just, doesn't just want anything.
Right.
He's like probably toughest, you know, he'll say, well, I don't think that one's a very good painting.
Well, that's good.
I've let things go to the gallery and then brought them back because, you know, it's always such a shock seeing something out of the studio. It always looks so different. So, but my biggest regret, I don't think I really have one just because, you know, even the paintings, at the risk of sounding too hippie, I do think there's something to be learned from the ones that I think didn't work as well. And, you know, I also know that it's one's own opinion about them changes so much. I often don't really trust it. So there might be paintings from 5 years ago that I am so embarrassed about. And then in another 5 years, I think, they look fine. They're good paintings.
Right.
And it's my own relationship to them. And, you know, it depends on what I'm working on at the moment. So I have close friends whose eye I really trust and who I trust to tell the truth. So,
how often do you think that you use kind of I would say the negative to guide the positive, such as that way? Like, do you have artists that, you know, you go see their show in Chelsea or something like that, and you're like, okay, now I know which way I'm not going. You know what I mean? Do you go that far, or do you tend to look more for positive role models or kind of that negative, like, against? What would you say? Speaking of hippie.
Well, I mean, I think it's much harder to emulate something and make it your own than it is, you know, you might see something that you think is a terrific show, but you don't want to obviously imitate it.
Right.
You might think, well, what can I take from this that I really like, and how do I, you know, how, I mean, occasionally it can be, what can I, literally, what can I steal?
Right.
You know, I'm going to just take that.
Right.
But that happens very little with me with contemporary art, just because I think people have such distinctive voices. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could say I really like the way Elizabeth Payton uses that gesso, and I'm going to try that. But it's so much hers,
right,
that even to... Okay, what I'd do with it would be different, but, I mean, that might be something you could try a medium you liked or admired the way someone else was doing. I'm trying to think... I mean, there's plenty that you see that you think, well, I don't want to do that. Or you think, well, I hope that's not what mine looks like.
What show were you least impressed with recently?
Let's see. What have I seen? Marlene Dumas.
I haven't been to see it.
Horrible. I do not get what that is, the fuss is about. Just really underwhelmed. A nice hand in places, but for me, big phony.
Good.
Yeah. Haven't seen that much else that causes such a strong reaction. I mean, I see certain things that leave me cold that I'm not that excited about. I think there's a lot of mediocre stuff, but...
Which some would argue is worse. That feeling of, like, you never saw a show that day.
Yes,
You go to Chelsea.
Well, that's the thing that puts you off ever going back to Chelsea, and you sort of, it becomes such a chore because you just think you're going to schlep around and see nothing you like.
Right.
But for example, I like Terry Winter's new paintings. And I think inevitably one has a kind of magpie attitude, because if you like something, you're like, well, what can I, you do, or I at least think, well, what can I take from that I liked? But I think I try and just absorb it. You know, that it's more of an attitude than actually trying to make marks similar to his or anything like that. Or, for example,
Occasionally, stealing color.
Yeah.
Like, you know, new color combinations that I've never seen before.
Right.
I'll straight up steal those.
Right, and I might steal from Terry Winter's I liked that he was using more transparent colors, which I, you know, often has had this heavy opacity to earlier things. And I thought the transparent thing was working really well for him. So, I also really like Sue Williams' new paintings. But that's something that I know I can't... She's so different that I don't really know how I...
Right.
How I steal that.
All right. Good. Good job.
But I think when I say attitude, I think you can just carry these people in your head. I mean, I think when you've seen good art, it just stays with you. And it's not, you know, it's not as if there's a specific thing you can take, but...
But the inspiration of that moment.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And that's what I look for, you know. And I'll go quite as often to the Met as I will to, let's say, the new museum.
Right.
You know, to look for things. Because, there's just something certain about, like, a... I don't know, it's something certain about, like, master artists, you know, that inspires
me. Yeah,
you know
me too.
What's your favorite museum in the world?
Probably the National Gallery in London.
Is it?
Yeah, just because... And I know it's partly just familiarity, because those were the works I looked at when I first wanted to paint.
Right.
And also that I don't get to spend very much time there now, so that it always seems like this incredibly precious... time, but also the Prado, the Kunsthistorisches in Vienna is pretty amazing. But those are the one in Vienna, that's one I've only visited sort of once and had a great day there. National Gallery I've gone back and back to, and is really, you know, there are such fantastic things that I've revisited over years and years. I love the De Menil Museum in Houston. And
I haven't been to that.
That's fantastic. And the there are museums I've only been to once, like the Kimball, I adored.
What do you think about like medical oddity museums, like the Mutter in Philadelphia?
Oh, I've never been there.
All right, go there. That's right. On your list.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love the Frick.
Frick, right, yes.
And I love the John Soames Museum in London, but that has some oddities.
What, as far as, you know, you showing and who your audience is, would you rather show in a museum or would you rather show in a gallery?
Well, I guess if you're in a museum, the advantage is you don't just get those contemporary art lovers who just, you know, have gone to Chelsea on purpose to look at. I think both, you know, if you want... museums in this country are revoltingly expensive. So, of course, I like the fact that anyone can walk into Gagosian, even though they probably anyone doesn't realise they can in some cases.
Right.
Of course... It would be thrilling to show somewhere where, you know, with a very high traffic. You know, I'm sure it must feel great to have a show up at the new museum and know that you're feeling, you know, that these people are just the sheer numbers of people whose eyes have passed over the work.
Right.
Quite exciting.
Have you ever done any public art then? I mean, when you talk about like audience.
Only at PS1.
Right.
At PS1, I did a wall painting. And as far as I know, it's still up. And who knows now Alana's gone, because I think Alana liked it. No, because Alana asked me to do it years and years ago, and it was only supposed to be up for one summer, and it ended up staying up, as far as I know, till now, and that must have been at least 10 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Good job.
But, still, it's in a museum. It's not really public.
Right.
I do think I have a greed for eyes on my work. I do think it's thrilling to feel like the more people have seen it, that it gets really... I had a show in Boston at the museum, and it's great to get a response and students seeing it. I mean, one always wants the young people,
right?
You know, to get hooked in.
Yeah.
So it's really exciting when you get a response and hear that, like, a class has gone to your show or something like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, both really. You need... It's great to have... I feel I'm rather... I'm just thinking about the experience. I mean, recently... I went to MoMA the other day, and it was horrible. It was so crowded. You couldn't see anything.
Oh.
And so the nice thing, in a way, about Chelsea being less... busy, you know, I can't stand the way museums are so packed now.
Right.
I know that's, you're supposed to be pleased if people like art, but I think a lot of the time they're there just as tourists and it's just another thing to do.
Right.
I mean, I went to Mirandi and it was a nightmare of screaming kids. I went to...
What do you think of the Mirandi show?
I loved it.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it. It was actually kind of a revelation. I hadn't seen that much of his in the flesh. And I was blown away.
Yeah.
That was probably my favorite recent show.
Totally surprise hit, too, though, I would say, because, you know, looking through Mirandi book or something like that, you know, that somebody's got laying on a coffee table or something, you're like, it's those damn jars again. Like, all right, but I got it.
Yeah.
But looking in person, there is something about it.
It's so different. Like, I didn't even bother getting the catalogue. I just thought it didn't look...
Yeah.
You couldn't tell at all. It actually did the works a disservice.
Yeah.
I'd rather not look at the picture of them. I'd rather just remember how magical they were.
Something super zen about the recombination of just a few elements.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You know, a just slightly different name. Much similar to animation in one frame different.
Yes,
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's about all the time we have.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Art International Radio at www.artonair.org. My name is Zephyr Thrall. The show is called Frank Prattle. You might also be listening, who knows, you know, at frankprattle.com, if you're lucky. And my special guest today has been Cecily Brown. We're here in her studio, and she's an amazing painter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.